Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with a radio program and podcast that aims to help you learn and improve your American English skills. We tell you about interesting and important events from around the world. We always present these stories at a slower speed. We also try to use a smaller number of words. That makes it easier to understand if English is not your first language. Today we have a special program about a very serious subject. In the last year, tensions between China and its neighbors have increased over conflicting claims to territory in the South China Sea. Japan has changed its laws to permit its forces to fight in support of allies. Experts are asking the question, is Eastern Asia becoming more militarized? To help us understand this complicated topic, here is Mario Ritter.
Territorial claims have become a stressful issue in East and Southeast Asia over the past few years. Conflicts over territory include the Spratly and Paracel Islands in the South China Sea. Countries dispute ownership, and China continues to expand its footprint. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke about the issue during Mr. Xi's state visit to the United States. At a joint news conference, President Obama repeated his concerns about the maritime territory.
We did have candid discussions on the East and South China Seas, and I reiterated the right of all countries to freedom of navigation and overflight and to unimpeded commerce.
Mr. Obama said he repeated concerns to Mr. Xi about land reclamation in the South China Sea. He said China's action of filling in land in disputed island areas makes it hard to resolve disputes peacefully with neighbors. President Xi defended China's claim to the area. He said China's construction work on artificial islands in the South China Sea does not target any country. He also said that China doesn't intend to pursue militarization. China claims much of the South China Sea as its territory. However, Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam also claim parts of Western Pacific waters. Over the past 45 years, all these nations have reclaimed land in the South China Sea. But their efforts are small compared to the 1,200 hectares reclaimed by China in the past 18 months. The sea is important as a waterway for international trade. It is estimated that 40% of world trade passes through the South China Sea. Free navigation of its waters is highly important. The sea is important for its resources, too. It contains important fisheries and is also believed to hold oil and natural gas reserves. China has accessed a large share of these resources. It dominates the region economically and geographically. It has built military bases on islands in the sea that include docks and airstrips. China is not alone in building an airstrip on islands in the sea, but its runways are large enough for military aircraft. This has worried its neighbors and the U.S. that China wants to control this area. The U.S. has said it is committed to open and free shipping in the area. Efforts by a group of Asian countries called ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, have not solved the issue. China is not a member of ASEAN, and the group is split. Countries with claims in the South China Sea want to enforce a code of conduct, but countries without claims are unwilling to push for that requirement. China's military presence looms large in the area. The country's military budget, officially at $145 billion, increased 10% in 2015. Many new weapons were on display at the recent World War II anniversary parade. They included the Dongfeng 21D missile, called the Carrier Killer, by Chinese media. China has an aircraft carrier base on Hainan Island in the South China Sea. In July, China accused the United States of militarizing the area because of U.S. surveillance patrols and joint military exercises with allies like the Philippines. Japan's constitution renounces war as a way to settle international disputes. On September 18th, the Japanese government changed laws relating to its constitution that allow Japan's self-defense forces to fight outside the country with allies even if Japan is not under attack. The changes were passed by a coalition of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's Liberal Democratic Party and the Kōmeitō Party. The changes caused large protests and sharp disagreement in Parliament. One public opinion study found that 54% opposed the bills, while 29% supported updating the Constitution. But Japan's neighbors, China and North and South Korea, were skeptical. Those countries have painful historical memories of Japanese occupation and colonization before World War II. China's official People's Daily Overseas Edition wrote that Prime Minister Abe had brought huge uncertainty to the security situation in the Asia-Pacific region. Jeff Kingston is director of Asian Studies at Temple University in Tokyo. He said Prime Minister Abe had not helped the public understand the new bills. China and Japan disagree over who owns islands in the Sea of Japan called Senkaku by Japan and Diaoyu by China. Neighboring South Korea also claims islands known as Dokdo in Korea and Takeshima in Japan. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to the program called As It Is from the Voice of America in Washington. If you are hearing this only on the radio, you are missing a great learning experience. If possible, find us on the internet and download the program as a podcast. That way you can save the sound and also copy the written words we say. Then you can go back again and again and listen and read along. you might want to try speaking some of the words and sentences we say. That's why we come to you every day, to tell you interesting things and help you learn American English. Please remember to come back again tomorrow for another look at our world as it is.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Health experts have long known that vitamin D is important for healthy bones and teeth. It may also help to protect the body against diseases such as diabetes and cancer. And now researchers say vitamin D might help fight brain diseases called dementias. Dementias are brain diseases that damage thinking and memory processes, what scientists call cognitive abilities. Dementias are difficult to treat. Taking care of someone who has dementia is extremely demanding, and the disease is very frightening to sufferers. Chris Roberts suffers from dementia. He says the worst part of living with this disease was getting lost while driving.
The worst thing that I found, I was getting lost in the car. I'd completely not just forget where I was going, I wouldn't know where I was.
More than 47 million people around the world suffer from dementia. The World Health Organization reports that 60% of them live in low and middle-income countries. Now, a new study in the United States shows a possible link between dementia and low levels of vitamin D. We get vitamin D from some foods like nuts, lentils, and fatty fish like salmon and mackerel. We also get vitamin D from the sun, but that is not dependable. In some parts of the world, there is not enough sunlight to provide enough vitamin D. Also, sunblock substances prevent the vitamin from entering the body. To add to the problem, the skin's ability to process vitamin D weakens as a person ages. As a result, low levels of vitamin D are common among older people. Researchers at Rutgers University in New Jersey are exploring the relationship between vitamin D and dementia. The team recently measured vitamin D levels and cognitive ability in older people. Nutritional sciences professor Joshua Miller led the team. He said cognitive abilities differed among the study subjects. He said tests showed that about 60% of the group was low in vitamin D.
Some of the subjects had outright dementia, some had mild cognitive impairment, and some had what we would call normal cognitive functioning.
Those subjects who had low vitamin D levels showed more short-term memory loss. They were also less able to organize thoughts, order tasks by importance, and make decisions.
Those who had dementia also had lower vitamin D status than those who had mild cognitive impairment or who had normal cognitive functioning.
The findings suggest that vitamin D might play a part in slowing dementia, but more studies are needed to see if vitamin D supplements could help. The research was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Neurology. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the election of Martin Van Buren as the 8th President of the United States. Van Buren had served as President Andrew Jackson's Secretary of State and later his Vice President. Jackson asked his political party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. The Whig Party was against him, but their opposition was divided. Van Buren won the election easily. Jackson stood beside Van Buren as the new president was sworn in at the Capitol building in Washington. Physically, the two men were very different. Jackson was tall, with long white hair that flowed back over his head. Jackson's health had been poor during the last few months he spent in the White House. He seemed tired. There was almost no color in his face. Van Buren was much shorter than Jackson and had much less hair. His eyes were brighter than those of the old man next to him. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren noted that he was the first American born after the Revolution to become President of the United States. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His family was Dutch. Van Buren said he felt he belonged to a later age. He called for more unity among Democrats of the North and South. He said better times were ahead for the country. Martin Van Buren had a poor education as a boy. He went to school only for a few years. His father was a farmer and hotel keeper at a small town in New York State. Politicians, including Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, had sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them and others, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended tenants and renters who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official and then a senator and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with. But she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with 4 sons.
And after that, he was known as quite charming among the ladies, as they said in those days.
Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. Mr. Silby says, most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his political life and his social life separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. But he did not have a national reputation like Andrew Jackson had.
What he was known for and what got him into the vice presidency and then the presidency was that he was Jackson's right-hand man.
Van Buren had been president for just a few days when an economic crisis struck the country. The crisis had been building for months. It really began with the death of the Bank of the United States more than a year before. The bank had been so strong that it was able to control the economy throughout most of the country. It also helped control smaller state banks. It refused to accept the notes or paper money of these banks unless the state banks could exchange the paper for gold or silver money. President Jackson had opposed the Bank of the United States. He vetoed a bill that would have continued it. After the powerful bank closed, a number of new state banks opened. All of them produced large amounts of paper money, many times the amount they could exchange for gold or silver. Business speculators used much of this paper money to buy land from the government. These men bought the land, held it for a while, then sold it for more than they paid. The government soon found itself with millions of dollars of paper money of questionable value. To stop these activities, Jackson had ordered only gold or silver payments for government land. But many banks did not have enough gold to cover the paper notes. At the same time, American agriculture was having trouble. In 1835 and 1837, many crops failed. American traders had to import farm products from Europe, and they had to pay for them in gold or silver. In the spring of 1837, just as Martin Van Buren was taking office, the demand on banks for gold and silver grew too heavy. The banks stopped honoring their promises to exchange their paper money for gold. They said the suspension was just temporary, that it was necessary to stop for a while all payments in gold or silver. The crisis became worse. Many of the weaker state banks closed. Those that stayed open had almost no money to lend. Businessmen could not pay back money they owed the banks, and they could not get loans to keep their businesses open. Many factories closed. Great numbers of people were out of work, and prices rose higher and higher. Most people struggled to buy food and other necessities. The price of flour and meat doubled between 1835 and 1837. Even coal, the fuel people used to heat their homes, cost two times as much. Violence finally broke out at a protest meeting in New York City. Some in the crowd demanded action against the rich traders. About 1,000 people marched to a store, forced their way into it, and destroyed large amounts of flour and grain. Businessmen blamed the government for the economic depression. They said the biggest reason was a decision former President Jackson made. Jackson's order required the government to accept only gold or silver for government land. Opponents said the order had caused fear and mistrust. Even some of Jackson's strongest supporters said it should be lifted. They said the measure had done its job of ending land speculation. Now, they said, it was hurting the economy. Two of President Van Buren's closest advisors urged him to continue the order. Lifting it, they argued, would flood the federal government with worthless paper money. Van Buren was troubled. The federal government had already lost $9 million because of bank failures. The president wanted to make sure the government had enough money, and he wanted this money safe until needed. Yet he did not believe the federal government had the responsibility for ending the Depression. And historian Joel Silby says Van Buren did not believe the government had the right to interfere in any way with private business.
He said that over and over again, that the federal government doesn't have the power to do this.
Mr. Silby adds that Van Buren's political philosophy grew out of the beliefs of former President Thomas Jefferson. All of his life, Van Buren claimed to be a Jeffersonian Democrat.
That had very specific meaning to him. Limited government, freedom for people, meaning white males. He was an egalitarian within the limits of those years.
Van Buren also shared Jackson's suspicion of bankers. In general, he believed no group, neither the government nor the wealthy, should have too much power, not even to help the economy. So Van Buren decided to continue Jackson's order. No government land could be bought with paper money. The American economy got worse. The president called a special meeting of Congress. In a message to lawmakers, Van Buren said overbanking and overtrading had caused the Depression. He proposed several steps to protect the government. One of them was for Congress to pass a law permitting the government to keep its own money in the Treasury. America's Treasury Department received money when it collected import taxes and sold land. It used this money to pay what the government owed. The Treasury did not, however, hold the money from the time it was collected to the time it was paid out. The Treasury put the money in private banks. President Van Buren wanted to end this custom. He wanted a law to let the Treasury keep government money in its own secure places. The Whigs criticized Van Buren for thinking only of protecting the federal government and not helping businessmen, farmers, and the states. Some Democrats, who believed strongly in states' rights, also opposed Van Buren's idea. All these opponents provided enough votes in Congress to defeat the proposal. Van Buren tried again the following year to get approval for an independent treasury. Again, the proposal was defeated. Finally, in June 1840, Congress passed a law enabling the Treasury Department to hold government money itself. Van Buren signed what was called the Independent Treasury Bill. But the economic depression continued. Martin Van Buren also faced an international challenge from a surprising place. The president's troubles with Canada will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.